Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema,
starring Alonzo Duralde, who is the reviews editor of The Wrap, who is also the co-host of Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network, who is also the co-host of Breakfast All Day, formerly known as What the Flick. I did it all.
You did it all. Look at
I
you.
I said it all without stumbling or forgetting who you are.
You're a wonder, Dave White. And you're Dave White. Also, film critic for The Wrap. You co-host all the Linoleum Knife shows with me. And for more of those,
there are other, well, yeah.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. No, we'll get into that later.
Right.
And, you know, maybe you've heard us on KCRW. Some people do.
Well, only if they live in Los Angeles.
No, it's on the internet.
It's a must hear.
It's out there. I think it gets syndicated or whatever they do at NPR. Television celebrity Denise Crosby told me at the USA Film Festival that she listens to us on KCRW.
Thank you, Denise Crosby.
It was very exciting. And that other voice you heard is one of our dearest, favoritest guests, gracing us with an appearance once again from the New York Times. Manola Dargis is here.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
You're fixing to go to Cannes, right?
I am. I'm packing. I'm starting to pack already. Days early, because you always forget something.
How long do you spend there?
Years. It's just, it's a very long festival. I think it's what's like 12 days or something. No. And it's just, it's relentless. You know, the first screening is at 8:30 in the morning.
Right.
And sometimes there are late screenings that, you know, don't finish until after midnight. And it's just, you know, yes, it is fun to be there. I am not going to complain. And we can bring out the world's smallest violin and start playing it. But it is.
Right. You have to wear gowns to some screen?
I don't wear gowns. I'm not a gown gal. But I have a kind of shiny old, like a coat that seems presentable. I can't actually really button it anymore over my expanded midsection, but if I leave it open, it's fine. And then what I do is I wear flip-flops over to the theater, and then I take my high heels out of my bag and change into my high heels so that I only have to walk a little bit into the theater.
Whoa. Now, what finally happened with the high heels on the red carpet rule? Did they get rid of that or no?
No, I don't believe so. I think that they've become a little bit more accommodating to shorter heels. Usually, I mean, most of the press, you know, they do not go to the red carpet. And frankly, once you've been on it, you never want to go back. It's not pleasant.
Oh, no, of course.
You know, no one cares about you. Right. You're like that. You know, who's that middle-aged pasty lady walking by looking very annoyed? That would be me. You know, everyone's there to see the beautiful people. And it's not always fun. I went to the premiere for this Lars von Trier horrible movie, The House That Jack Built, last year. And it was at 10:30, but it actually didn't start till 11. It was a three-hour movie about a serial killer. You can see the mood I was in when it was over. But in order to interview them next day, that was the only screening that made sense. So it's, you know, again, I'm very happy, very privileged to be there. It's great. I love going, but it's for us, it's work.
I want to go to Cannes and just follow and not do the festival at all. I just want to follow Hong Sang-soo around as he makes a movie on the fly. Like, he just grabs Isabelle Huppert. It's like, you want to make a movie in like 3 days? Sure, let's go.
Lots of drinking. Lots of talking.
We're just sitting around.
Because that's what's great about Venice is that, like, yeah, there's a press screening at 8 a.m., but that's also what's going to be the big movie that night at 8 p.m. So you're done. Like, I'm like, by 4 in the afternoon, I've seen like 2 movies, I've filed, and, you know, anything else after that is gravy.
Holy hell.
Yeah, they really arrange the day nicely for press, I gotta say.
It's Italy, that's why.
It's Italy.
Yeah. Can't be bothered.
The French are on timetables.
More
spritzes,
please. So this is a very special Linoleum Knife. We're not talking about the week's new movies. We will do another episode.
We're doing that one tomorrow.
Yes, where we'll talk about Longshot and other stuff. But we've been talking to Manolo for a while about coming in to talk about sort of random series of deaths that have occurred lately.
We're here to talk about death today.
I'm like the Grim Reaper of cinema.
Yeah. Everyone's been dying in large amounts lately. Filmmakers have been dying. And the filmmakers that have been dying are people we like who you described, Ms. Dargis, in an email to me as off Hollywood.
Yeah, so we're not talking about John Singleton. We're not talking about Stanley Donen, who are great and who have been very much appreciated and remembered in other venues. But we want to talk a little more about some that maybe got less coverage in the mainstream media.
And got no in memoriam, what's the card?
Whatever card yeah.
at the Academy Awards.
And we'll not get it next year if they missed it. Yeah, they're...
So the main four we're focusing on today, right?
Yes.
Okay. Filmmaker and archivist Jonas Mekas. Filmmaker and documentarian and archivist in her own way, Agnes Varda. Writer, director Larry Cohen. And...
Barbara Hammer.
Thank you. Documentarian Barbara Hammer. Sorry, flew out of my head.
Avant-garde filmmaker.
Yeah. Avant-garde, yes, absolutely. Where do you want to start?
I think let's start with Agnes Varda.
Yeah.
Who I go back and forth between calling properly Agnes Varda and Agnes Varda. So please forgive me. I do know how to pronounce it, but I'm an American and we just...
Old habits die.
I'll tell you something. We knew an Agnes about 20 years ago. And when I heard her say her name, I thought, oh, okay, well, that's how they do it in France. And so from that
moment... I've been saying Agnes B for all this time.
From that moment on, I was like, it's not Agnes B, it's Agnes B. And it's not Agnes Varda, it's Agnes Varda. And the minute I learned that person's name and how to say it, I thought, I know some French now. And so that's just me. But you can call her Agnes or Agnes. She doesn't care.
She does not care. I'm just gonna start with a little anecdote, which actually I wrote about her after she died. And I'll start with the same anecdote because it was meaningful to me. So as we know, companies arrange little dinners. There's a filmmaker in town and they'll arrange these little intimate. Sometimes it's a big thing, sometimes it's a little thing. And I was invited back in 2009 to, it was probably July, to a dinner for her new movie, The Beaches of Agnes. Mm. And yes, The Beaches of Agnes. And I had already reviewed it for the New York Times. And so I was like, I didn't really know if I should go. You know, these are always really tricky because we want to stay on one line and, you know, ethically. At the same time, part of, you know, when you go to Cannes, for example, or Toronto or other film festivals, and I know that must be true at Venice as well, there are these dinners and you have these dinners and it's kind of basically journalists and the industry meeting and, you know, having a glass of wine and maybe kind of scowling at each other and maybe actually even talking. And then I just thought, you know, it's Agnes Varda. Bleep it. I'm gone. You know, I just thought I'm going to go. So I show up at this at the restaurant, and it's a very small table, and she's late, and then she's very late. And finally, she bustles in a great state. She had been at a Starbucks waiting for dinner to begin, and her bag had been stolen with everything in it, including her camera, which I guess was at that point a digital camera. And she was very upset because it had all the images that she had shot the day of her good friend Sharon Stone. So you're me. You're at a restaurant. You're meeting Agnes Varda, legendary filmmaker, hero, and she's friends with Sharon Stone? This is the only thing I could... I could not make sense of
it. Tell me everything.
I was like, wait, what?
I love that.
I know, it's so random. But it's not, because she knew everybody.
Yeah.
Beyond the fact that at that point she was in her 80s and she'd been around for a long time, she had also spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, including some years in the late 60s when she lived here with Jacques Demy, her husband.
Right. He came here to make Model Shop, and then she did some docs and a feature called Lions, Love and Lies?
Yes. And she was actually trying to make a studio film, but she couldn't get a final cut, and she was like, forget that, you know? Because I'm that kind of person, I was like, okay, we're going to the police station. So I went with the publicist, turned out to be Sacha Baron, Berman. And we went off to the police station in Hollywood. And yes, the whole time was like muttering about how young the desk cop was. It was really funny. Filled out a report. And then came back to the restaurant and had a nice dinner. I mean, she was distracted. You know, it's interesting. She invited me to a few other things. They were all like film related. You know, they were things like, oh, she had some work shown at LACMA and would I like to come? And so I would go there. But then I also ran into her at Cannes. That seems very like, again, this is very, very, very fancy, right? But, you know, there's a party and I'm wandering around in despair because I don't know anyone and I feel like I should be there because maybe something will happen. But really, I just want to go home. And there's Agnes Varda and I've met her and I'm like, oh, hi. And over that was back in 2008, I guess. And over the years, I would see her every so often. And then we had a series of lunches that were really lovely at her house, which her house is actually in Beaches. You'll get to see it. It's a really beautiful space that she lived in for decades. And it was very. It was funny, people ID'd me as her friend, and I never felt that I was her friend. It was somebody that I knew. I had felt like this is a professional relationship. Sure. But she knew everybody. You know, there was like these photos floating around of her and Harrison Ford, because back when Demi and Varda were living in Los Angeles, Demi wanted to hire this unknown actor named Harrison Ford, and the studio said no. And we know what happens to Harrison Ford, right? But there were these wonderful photos because they stayed in touch and she was friends. And the other one that I thought was amazing was she was friends with Zalman King and his wife. They were all friends together. So she had deep movie history and deep connections that had gone back for a long time. And so that was just part of her. And then there were the movies, you know, which we've all seen.
And that is how... you know, that's my only point of entry, obviously. But the I remember seeing Cleo from 5 to 7 for the first time, many years ago, and thinking, who is this woman?
1962.
Who is this director? And then seeing Vagabond later and thinking, oh, that's the same person. You see, when you're landlocked and you're outside of any kind of, you know, film culture and you're just grasping for whatever you can get that comes your way, if you are pre-internet, you are making these you're making these connections in your head in a very slow way, you know. And then, the early stuff was very spotty for me. And later when the documentaries began in earnest is when I really began to fall in love with what she was doing.
Yeah. See, I kind of came to her backwards. I really started with the documentaries.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until after seeing like The Gleaners and I and Jaco de Nantes and stuff. That I then started working backwards and getting to Cleo and getting to the different, you know, features.
One that I had not seen, and I know I've done this already, and I promise we're not on their payroll, but the Criterion Channel.
Yay.
Is so wonderful.
Yep.
And I watched Le Bonheur for the first time.
Oh, my Lord. Is that just a... That is an amazing movie. Okay, so
A glass of ice water in the face.
We need to spend a little. This is one of her lesser known, because The Gleaners and I is perhaps the made in 2000 documentary, perhaps her most famous movie, at least for Americans. And then maybe Cleo. And Vagabond really kind of disappeared. I really would like that to kind of come back to people's consciousness. It's made in 86. That is a total mind-blowing movie. Yeah. But so is Le Bonheur. And what's interesting is all of them are very, very different stylistically.
Yeah.
Visually, if you look at them, you can't necessarily kind of connect them. It's not like she has these kind of obvious, always visual signatures. Though she right. moves the camera a lot. You know, whether... You know, in Vagabond, there's a lot of traveling shots. You're traveling with, it's about a vagabond, a young woman who's homeless on the road, and everything that's happening, all the harsh things that are happening to her. And the camera is often moving with her. And of course, later on, Agnès Varda herself is on the move. She's, I always think of her, she's a woman on the move. And so the camera's moving because she's moving a lot. But these movies are very, very different. I think what connects them are, you know, it's her and her sensibility and a certain kind of, a toughness that I think people don't always acknowledge or want to accept or see, in part because toward the end of her life, she was a very cute old lady, yeah. and she would kind of play that role somewhat.
La grand-mère.
Right. But she was also a really tough woman.
Oh, yeah.
Incredibly tough.
You do not run with the French New Wave kids as pretty much the only woman
right.
in that crowd.
And or make movies like Vagabond
exactly.
or Le Bonheur. And yeah. I would love, if you want to talk a little bit, can we talk
sure.
a few minutes about
Please.
Le Bonheur? And,
it's about a young couple. And they seem to exist in an almost dreamlike state of happiness and pleasure.
All right, can we just, for once, I thought, to me, yes, perfectly put, but yeah. also as if they're in a Jacques Demy movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, weird. And this is 1965, by the way.
Uh-huh, yeah. And
everything's bright and beautiful and everything's smiley.
Everything's colorful and the outfits are cute. And like, you're thinking, what's going to happen? Like, I began to feel this tension build, although the film wasn't giving me one hint that something terrible was about to come down. And the husband begins seeing another woman. And you think, okay, well, it's France. I mean,
it's
sure,
the
fine,
French.
Fine.
Like, you know, exactly.
I guess that's what this movie's about. Yeah. And then, as blithely as in a Jacques Demy film, he says to the wife, well, now I have more love. I have an extra love. And there's just going to be so much more love for all of us. And I'm like, speak for yourself.
I know.
I'm yelling at him from the couch.
Yes.
And she accepts this weird little monologue that he gives her. It's a short film. It's like 80 minutes. She appears to accept this little sort of
announcement that he makes.
It's an announcement, yeah. But it's this sort of like, and now we begin a new phase in our love life with each other, and the way we all live together happily, and I'll love you and I'll love her and we'll all be so happy. And she's like, okay, that's fine.
It's not fine.
In the final moments of this film, she drowns herself. The end.
Yep, that's it. It's a kick in the gut.
And,
it really is. It's a kick in the gut.
Because, I mean, the title means happiness.
I was saying, she beat Todd Solondz to
yeah,
that
she
one.
Sure did. When it was over, I thought, oh, Miss Varda. But it all made perfect sense. And, given the other films of hers that I've seen, those earlier narrative films.
And it's interesting because she had, by all accounts, this loving marriage with Jacques Demy.
And she did.
Who, at the same time, was a gay man who clearly was pursuing other
yeah.
avenues of love and died of AIDS.
She understood.
Or AIDS complications.
She understood their marriage.
Yes.
And understood that, I think, and this is me guessing.
Yeah.
I assume she understood that their marriage was going to have this complication. Like, whenever she found out.
Yeah.
You know. And yet she stayed with him.
They had two children.
They had right. Rosalie, her daughter is by someone else actually.
Oh, okay.
And then Mathieu, who is Demi and her kid, and they took his name, and Demi raised Rosalie, but She actually, Varda had Rosalie out of wedlock, and I, you know, which is no big deal, but 1950s Catholic France, mm-hmm. I sure, believe, totally. Was a big deal. Actually, right. I think Rosalie is early 60s. So I don't know. I do know, we do know that Demi, I don't know if he ever talked about being a gay man. He seems to have been gay or certainly bisexual.
Right.
He certainly then dies from complications of AIDS.
Yeah.
She is super circumspect about it. She did not, I have not found any interview. There might be interviews where she talks about it.
Very little.
But it's very oblique.
Right.
You know, and, you know, her obvious love for him did not wane because of this, which doesn't mean that there wasn't hurt and difficulties. You know, I believe at one point she says in Beaches, I watched it again.
Right.
She That's actually mentions about that they seem to not be living together, and then suddenly he's living with her again.
Yeah.
And I think what it is that he was sick, and she basically, they took care of him, the children and her, until he died, you know?
And then she became the caretaker of his legacy and making sure that all of his films were being restored and being preserved and reissued and all that stuff.
So whatever went on with those two people,
right.
you know, what came out of it really, to me, seems like a very, every relationship is its own mystery, right? Mm-hmm. And she protected it, and also then honored what could be shared with everyone else, you know, which I thought was just the most beautiful thing, because finally they were two artists together making work and you know, loving cinema and having this shared passion. And I just found it deeply moving. Like, however they worked out the complications privately, you know, the way that she presented and they presented publicly was as this really kind of extraordinary couple. And she was, when she would talk about him, she still was very moved. You know, she was deeply moved by him. Yeah. I mean, it must have been an awful death. I would assume that's part of it. Awful.
Right. Yeah.
But I just think, you know, the love endured in a profound way that's just deeply touching.
And one of the things that I love about the documentaries that came later is that overwhelming sense of her love of life and her friends and her family and her work and everything. And it can be weird to hear her and watch her be this sort of generous, open person. And then watch those earlier films where really difficult, complicated women are doing really difficult, complicated things. And there is, I think sometimes maybe, you know, this idea of the 1960s as being one way. And often it felt like her characters were going in a whole other direction. You know, is it good for a woman who finds out that her husband is having an affair with another woman, you know, is it good for her to go kill herself? Is that a satisfying, you know, narrative ending?
And she was criticized by some, different feminists at different periods would criticize her work, but, you know, she just didn't fit into some sort of, you know, her feminist, right, absolutely. I think, you know, she was absolutely a feminist. I would say she was a radical feminist.
Yeah.
But she wasn't making movies that were going to be like nice feminism, and she wasn't making movies that were easy feminism. Mm. It is really tough. This kind of sense of, like, in Le Bonheur, is this woman, you get the sense of women being really disposable.
Yeah.
For me, that movie is such a, like, amazing. Like, I found a new wife, goodbye, you know, like,
right.
And you kind of have to accept it, because, I mean, that movie has such an amazing, in the first shot, which is over the opening credits, is the family walking, and they're blurry, and they're walking in a field of sunflowers, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very yellow, and it's very beautiful. And then they come closer and closer and closer. But it's kind of the sense of, like, the emergence of this family, of this, you know, heterosexual unit. They have this kind of picture-perfect life. And yet we understand that he works in a garage, does he not? Or am I inventing that?
Yes.
I believe he does.
Oh, like in Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he does. I think I'm not misremembering.
Or carpentry.
He works in some sort of manly thing, right? Where you do things with tools and hands. Yeah. But it did make me think very much of Schoberg, you know, like, and I thought, because I do feel like they could start singing. It's so cheerful and the colors are so bright and it seems, and yet there's something else that's really terrible. Mm-hmm. And you think about those first three features, you know, if we go from Le Pont Court, which she makes when she's in her mid-20s, she makes this before the 400 Blows, Truffaut's, you know, before Breathless, she's basically showing the French New Wave the way. She is there before anyone else. And then she makes Cleo, and then she makes, I guess, Le Bonheur, and then Vagabond later. These are all very tough feminist movies.
Yeah. And what are we to make of Kung Fu Master? You know?
Well, that's a very curious
movie. That's where I was. That's what I was going to say next, is the a movie like Kung Fu Master is... She's inviting you to dislike this person.
Right.
And saying, look, every instance of freedom that we have is not always going to be used wisely.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, but anyway, go on.
No. I was just thinking about her. I just think the kind of rigor and sometimes even severity with, like, Vagabond, for instance, you know, seems very different with Gleaners and I. But again, like, we're watching the Gleaners and I, we can talk about the other movies. There's this moment in the Gleaners and I where she's talking, she's driving, and she has a close-up of her hand.
Yes.
And she says the horror of it, you know? and it's the of aging, you know? And I think, in a way, again, because she later in life had this persona, and she was so cheerful and seemed so buoyant, she seemed very cute. But here's a woman holding up her wrinkled, spotted, age-spotted hand and talking about the horror of this.
Yeah.
You know, that she is very... And she lives another 20... I mean, another, you know, how many more years? I mean, it's extraordinary.
Right.
And she just kept on going. And you thought, like, living and filmmaking and living were the same thing for her at the same time. So I'm just saying that toughness continues. But she's uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, casting her own son in Kung Fu Master. It's been a long time since I saw that movie. I admit.
Charlotte Gainsbourg talks about how she hated making that, and also
because they were camped out in her house for like a year,
a whole year, because they were there for that movie and then also for
Jane Bay Par Anis.
Yeah, yeah. Day. And so Charlotte Gainsbourg has said, "I can't. I didn't want. I just wanted everyone to go home."
Yeah. So Varda starts out making a documentary about her friend Jane Birkin, and then that segues into this movie Kung Fu Master, where Birkin plays a middle-aged woman who enters into a sexual affair with a 14-year-old boy Matthew played DeMille. By Matthew DeMille, Varda's son.
Right.
And
also just Jane Birkin, for those who don't know, was a longtime lover of Serge Gainsbourg and also the mother of Charlotte Gainsbourg.
Right.
Who...
You saw her in Blow Up.
Who, at age 13, recorded a duet with her father,
called
Serge...
Charlotte did, yes.
Charlotte, yes. Yes. Charlotte Gainsbourg recorded incest. A duet with her husband, with her father,
nice
at age 13. The song was called Lemon Incest, and it was a big hit.
In France.
And so, you know... These are themes that pop up in popular culture
in 70s.
Other places that are not the United States.
They're exploring. Yes, right. But I think Varda was unafraid. She was a very fearless filmmaker, you know. And all the while she's, you know, she makes these features, she makes feature documentaries, and she makes a lot of really wonderful shorts, including a really great short on the Black Panthers. She goes and interviews Huey Newton.
And that's on the Criterion Channel right now.
Yeah, and you should watch that, because that's an amazing documentary. She is going there and she's interviewing the Panthers and hanging out with them. And when a lot of white people were not doing that, and she was like, oh, what? This is interesting. Let me go film this.
Right.
You know, super awesome.
Muir Mirrors is really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Move at the walls.
She would talk about Chicanos and how Chicanos had been oppressed in the United States. I mean, she was so far ahead, you know, of so
You can
many
come people. In from another country into a new country and say,
hey,
I see the thing that's wrong here.
Yes.
Do you all see the thing that's wrong here? And in a way that is perhaps even easier than for people who are living in the middle of it all.
Sure. Yeah.
I think in a way, because she didn't worry that it was in any way, you know, quote unquote, inappropriate for her right. as a white woman to go and investigate racism in the United States. Or as a foreigner, she just felt completely like this was a matter of right and wrong and ethics.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that, you know, an ethical person is, of course, an ethical political person is, of course, going to interrogate this.
We should move along to some of the other folks we're talking about.
Yes.
Yes.
So Larry Cohen, Dave and I watched The Stuff today.
Awesome movie.
Which I had never seen.
Wonderful. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I loved it. Yeah.
Wow.
His movies are wonderful.
Yeah.
Go on. Talk about The Stuff.
So the premise of The Stuff is that
1985.
There is some sort of mysterious goop coming out of the ground that is delicious. And so
and the very first scene is a guy just sticking his hand into it and putting his hand into his mouth. Like a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
And you're like, you don't know what that is.
You don't know where that's been.
But so it becomes this like, you know, hugely popular and everybody is like, you know, oh, I'm addicted to it, but they really are addicted to
right.
it. And
I'm a chocoholic,
but for booze. But yeah, so and then eventually it like takes over your body and controls you. And so it is a metaphor for a million different things, for
right.
like for trends, for capitalism, for drugs, you name it. And you know, so Michael Moriarty is a sort of shady ex-FBI agent who's been hired by ice cream companies to figure out just what the stuff is. And of course, you know, it gets more and more dangerous the closer he gets to the truth, with the help of ad exec Andrea Markovici and Famous Amos type cookie entrepreneur
Chocolate
Garrett
Chip
Morris.
Charlie.
Yeah, I've only seen a handful of Cohen films, but I gotta say, I think he's got way better ideas than execution generally.
Oh, his execution is very sloppy. I mean, I'm not gonna compare him to Philip K. Dick, but it's kind of like the way you think about Philip K. Dick is great stories, but not necessarily the most beautiful prose,
sure.
you know. And so, but his stuff was just, you know, there was a point in the 80s where I just could not wait to see the new Larry Cohen movie. I mean, it was just, and it really felt like he was like, there was a kind of moment, you know, there was Romero and there was Carpenter, and Cohen I saw as kind of being part of that. Again, maybe not as visually interesting, but certainly incredible, weird stuff, you know. I mean, God told me to.
Yeah.
It's alive. Cue
the Winged Serpent.
The Winged Serpent. And then doing things like The Private Lives of J. Edgar Hoover, which
yeah.
is an really interesting movie.
And writing Phone Booth, which apparently
right.
was a movie that he was trying to get made forever.
Right, right.
And they literally, I think, finally made it like the last year where you could even find a phone booth in New York City.
Right, right. Well, that's Colin Farrell, right?
Yeah,
I believe,
yeah. Joel Schumacher
yeah,
directed
yeah,
it.
Right, right.
His sister was Ronnie Chasen?
I did know that, yes. Oh. I think very interesting.
She's a legendary publicist here.
But it's interesting. Cohen kind of represents something that I just feel like it feels kind of lost to me. Maybe
oh, yeah.
I'm wrong, but it just
I
feels,
think it is
you know,
lost.
There's a kind of sense of doing this real B movie with maybe like C level, you know, special effects.
Yeah, but like an A-minus cast.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is Michael Moriarty before Law and Order, I believe,
right.
you know.
After Holocaust.
Yeah, right. So, but doing something that's inventive, that has a little bit of special effects, but it mainly is about imagination
yeah.
and having a certain kind of, in a way, I think, kind of post-Watergate paranoia about the world, you know, post-Vietnam. Like, it's just. And then, you know, I mean, you know, we're in the middle of the Reagan years at this point, right? It's
right.
kind of an interesting.
Yeah, The Stuff is totally about Frusenplage.
I know. I know that God Told Me To is the cool kid choice.
Mm.
And I love God Told Me To because it's just so freaky.
1976.
And you know, all the weird, like, we don't have to go over this again, but the Jesus movement of the time.
Yes.
And how it intersected with my family mm. and then me as a child growing up around that and watching behaviors on the part of people that I knew. And then later in life, seeing God Told Me To and thinking, oh yeah, this is completely, people would totally behave this way. I know that God Told Me To is the cool kid choice, but come on. It's Alive is one of my all-time
oh my
favorite films. and it is because of a couple reasons. One, when I was a little kid and I saw the teaser trailer on TV and it's just the bassinet. and a voiceover that says there's something wrong with the Davis baby.
Yes.
It's alive. Don't see this movie alone. Please. And I saw, and it was, I was like 9 or 10 and it was rated PG. And I thought, I get to go see this without a parent. I'm crawling,
you did go see it alone.
I'm crawling out of my skin. I'm so scared of this commercial, but I'm thinking, I have to know what happens. Because there's like a little claw.
Yeah.
I have the poster. We have the poster. A little claw coming out of the bassinet. And I was like,
must see.
I think I had never seen a film. Because I was 9. I had never seen a film. And to this day, what I love about Larry Cohen's films is that it's like the equivalent of someone getting you in a crooked hallway and like slamming you up against it and being like, yeah, boo! Okay, now this, boo! Like, I'm going to throw you into another wall. Boo! Because, as you said, it's very sloppy filmmaking.
It's by the throat.
And it's just so jarring. Like, everything is so jarring. There's like no connection between scenes. And like there's a new thing happening and people are screaming at each other and you don't know why. Because the actors are not being directed to more subtle performances. And then you never see the baby. You see the baby in glimpses. It's like Jaws, only it's before Jaws. Like you see the baby just like here and there or in a bush and it's going like lunging at you and it's like a split second of screen. Everything is so jarring and so blunt force in that film that I've seen it. I don't know how many times I've seen it. I could watch it again today right now. Like, that's so much fun.
It's interesting because, you know, he created this TV show, The Invaders, which was sort of an early X-Files kind of like aliens have invaded and nobody believes them, that kind of show.
Right.
And I was thinking about how you have this tradition of American dramatic filmmakers like Lumet and Frankenheimer coming out of the early days of live TV, and how Cohen is sort of coming out of genre television, like even directed some Columbos, I think, and kind of bringing that sort of fast, cheap, you know, direct aesthetic to filmmaking.
It's exploitation.
It's exploitation cinema, sure, yeah.
I love how that still, for me, is still a form of commentary.
But you could take all those ideas that he had, and so many of them being so metaphorical about different, you know, kind of political issues or whatever, and he could have been a great Rod Serling. Like, right. He could have had a half-hour show every week with something, and it would have been a metaphor for another thing, and there would have been a couple of good scares in it, and, like, that might have been his, you know... Who knows?
I think about It's Alive as sort of like a Roe v. Wade kind of movie.
And about thalidomide. And
thalidomide.
You know. Yeah.
It's just a way, a movie like that is a way to process, you know, when you tap into people's anxieties of the moment, you're still giving them a way to process it. Mm. Even if you don't necessarily have a coherent thing to say.
I mean, the other person I forgot to mention, I was mentioning these various, is Cronenberg. You know, I mean, it's interesting to think about, they're making all these movies kind of not too far apart.
True, yeah.
But
The Brood and Scanners.
Right,
and
right, exactly. I was thinking about, you know, I mean, Scanners, you know, which my head popped off when I watched that movie. I bet it didn't explode happily. But just that they were kind of tapping into something. These movies were these kind of fears. But, you know, Cronenberg then kind of becomes more of a legit, quote unquote, director.
Sure,
kind of graduates out, you know, gets bigger budgets, movie stars. And Cohen just kind of stays cheap, you know, he really kind of stays there. But I was just thinking about, you know, once upon a time back in the old days, now I'm going to walk down, you know, memory lane. You knew, like, these movies would open in certain theaters, or you knew what they were.
Like,
you know?
Times Square.
Yeah, kind of, or just like you understood that that's what that was. And I don't even know where I would look these days, you know? Like, also because so many big budget movies are really exploitation movies, right? I mean, Roger Corman's talked about how, like, he made his movies and then...
Like The Fast and the Furious is a B movie, but it's got like a very A budget. And, and of course, now there's that whole nonsense of like, oh, well, it's elevated horror.
Yes.
You know, which is like, in other words, so if you're embarrassed to say that you like horror, you could say, oh, no, this one's important. So
these are old-fashioned grindhouse, you know, materials. So.
You grow up in a small town, though. Everything weighs the same.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not become a citizen of a big city until I was 19, And so
you have two screens.
You have a little, a little town, and you have 2 to 4 screens in your town, maybe if you're lucky. And so, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is on one screen at the Jerry Lewis Twin Cinema.
Awesome.
And It's Alive is on the other one, or, you know, something else that's crazy and like, you know, Mako, Jaws of Death, you know, like right. that kind of thing. And so, I didn't learn until later. Again, like I said earlier, you know, the connections you're making are slow, and you're trying to sort out, well, this is a movie, and this is also a movie.
But there's a difference.
They're so different. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the 70s was maybe kind of the end of that idea of all these different kinds of films. Like, yeah, because I remember, like, there was a 3-screen theater near me, and like on one screen was Foul Play, but on another one was, you know, Let's Scare Jessica to Death or whatever. Right. You know? So it just, yeah, it was kind of random.
Let's talk about Jonas Mekas.
Ah, yes.
And I can't pronounce his last name either, because I've heard it pronounced Mekas, Makas, and Mekas. And I don't know. Because
I always called him Mekas, but I believe that's incorrect. I believe it is Mekas, but I'm just going to
say whatever we want.
I think we should just say whatever we... Exactly right. So Jonas Mekas, that's how I know his name, died in January 2019. And really...
96.
Amazing. One of the great, interesting lives. There was a shadow over his life the last 6 months, which we can talk about. But Mekas is very important in terms of independent film. Long before Robert Redford started skiing near Sundance, Mekas was already very instrumental in a kind of off-Hollywood alternative to mainstream filmmaking. He was very, very excited by the French New Wave. Of course, you know, we all, this is like, there's a continuity here. There's Agnes Varda, who shows the way for the French New Wave. Mekas is super interested in them and sees the possibilities, not just aesthetically, but also in terms of a kind of infrastructural alternative, which is really important.
His backstory reminds me a lot of Eric Rohmer's, where, you know, he had that Latin Quarter Cinema Club, and that's where, you know, like young Godard and young Truffaut and all these guys were sort of hanging out and watching films. And he, in the same way, was also kind of, in addition to creating art, was sort of presenting a place for it to be
realizing shown. That I mean, one of the long-standing problems with making alternative work is really how do you get it to the public, right? And so when the major distributors have that locked in and they're working with the major exhibitors, what do you do? And so Mekas was working with, you know, providing alternative means of exhibition. He was really, though, he saw it, you have to have distribution and exhibition, but he was really hitting it on all different levels. He was also the first film critic for the Village Voice, which is really important. And his work was just superb. I mean, he seemed to write kind of the way he made movies as well, which is very kind of stream of consciousness in a lot of ways, editing in camera and just kind of free flowing. Very great stuff. And then he was the one who brought in Andrew Saras to write for the Village Voice. And Saras had already written for Mekas and his brother Adolphus, who was also a filmmaker, had a really wonderful magazine called Film Culture. Which was publishing people like Pauline Kael, Manny Farber, and Andrew Saras back in the day. And I actually have an issue in which all three of them are in it, which is really, really cool. So Mekas is writing about movies. He's making movies. Most of his stuff initially is much more narrative, and then he kind of breaks away from that. And he's interested. He writes a manifesto in 1960s, very famous, called Cinema of the New Generation, in which he's like, we have to make movies made with blood. We have to move away from these, you know, completely moribund work, you know, see what the new wave is doing. But really talking about how can you be a film artist?
Right.
You know, people aren't talking about product. They're not talking about content. They are talking about art. It's a three-letter word. Yeah. And how do you get that work out there? And so he was instrumental in founding Anthology Film Archives, which still exists in New York City, which shows movies, and also Filmmakers Cooperative, which distributes movies as well. And these things are still going.
Yeah, and as an exhibitor, you know, he was a big fighter against censorship because he got in trouble for screening, it was a double feature of Flaming Creatures and Shaun D'Amour.
Yeah, right. Smith's great video of Flaming Creatures, right?
And Jean Genet's film. Right. But went to court and was like, no, this is, you know, this is an art form. There's freedom of expression. These films need to exist. They need to be seen. And, you know, that's a big step in making the 60s happen in a lot of ways.
I forget, were you at when Mikus got an award from LAFCA? Were you there that night?
I was, yeah.
It was actually kind of really touching, and I wish we had a some sort of tape of it.
I bet we do. I think somebody records it every year.
Because he was really excited to be in the room, and it was the same year that Clint Eastwood was there as well, and he, and I believe Spielberg was there.
Oh, right, yeah, for Letters to Iwo Jima.
Yeah, yeah. And Mikus was very excited, and when he was on stage, he was kind of addressing these other filmmakers who were probably thinking, I don't know who this is. But he is, you know, the way that I think with the similar to Varda is that, you know, he didn't just see himself as being in a niche, you know,
right.
He didn't see himself as being in this little, you know, oh, we're separate, or it's, you know, it was film, it was all that. And so he, like Spielberg, like Eastwood, is making movies, and they're, you know, this is about cinema, and that, which I find very beautiful and kind of utopian.
If you have Amazon Prime, you can get a free 2-week trial to Fandor. The Fandor is a streaming platform that's like $3.99 a month or something like that.
I think so, yeah.
But if you've already got Amazon Prime, and a lot of people do, you can get this. You can get this free 2-week trial and not have to pay a dime to watch several of his films that are on there right now. You can watch Walden.
Oh, which is beautiful.
Which is a wonderful, wonderful 3-hour. Don't freak out when I say 3-hour.
You sat through Endgame.
This is not. Indeed, you did. Pointing at the microphone right there. This is not slow cinema. This is jumpy, jumpy, fast cinema.
Very.
It's a mad, 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 mad world of the post-war avant-garde.
It is.
And everybody's in it.
And everybody's in it.
John and Yoko are in it. My friend Amy Taubin's in it. Everybody's in it.
He just throws out the, and now we're at Stan and Jane's place. We're riding ponies. And he's up at Stan Brackage's place up in upstate New York, and the three children, all with wild names. You think celebrities have only started recently naming their kids crazy things? Go online and look at the Brackage children's names. They're wonderful. But there's like nothing to do because it's like this farmhouse in the middle of the country, and it's just Mecca's holding his camera and the kids are rolling around in the dirt. And then they get on the ponies, or they're donkeys. They're riding these little miniature donkeys around. It's a 3-hour collection of home movies. But his home is New York City in the 1960s, so hey, everything looks amazing. And all the people who were doing all the things are there. And it doesn't feel, as you're watching it, it doesn't feel like a scene. It feels like a bunch of friends doing all of these things that they would become well known for either at that moment or later on.
Everybody, poets, writers, just everybody is there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think his movies are, we think about this kind of American movies have to be about something.
Right.
And they almost are sometimes almost accidentally about life. Mm. It's so interesting. And I think that Mikus's work is about life and beauty. And he'll have these images of like a flower bobbing in the wind, you know, and it can be like heart piercing, beautiful. And it's about these kind of moments of grace in life, you know, and they're reveries. And he is thrilled to be alive. I mean, this is someone who was a displaced person after World War II and was in various internment camps with his brother, and arrived on a boat, you know, to New York Harbor. I actually found the newspapers used to run articles about a new boat of displaced people, and I found the boat that he arrived on, and I sent him the article and said, "I think this is the boat you arrived on." I had done a story with him, and he's like, "Yes, it is." He liked me because my last name is Lithuanian, so it's my stepdad. But I used to write when I first started writing. I was my first gig, professional gig, was writing about avant-garde cinema for the Village Voice, and that's a very small world. And so I would see him. I was very shy, you know, but I would see him at Anthology or challenging someone at the Collective for Living Cinema and complaining about this and whatever. You know, I mean, he was there, and you just felt he was tireless, and he was still going into his mid-90s. Kind of incredible.
Yeah. There's also, on Fandor, you can see Lost, 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 which is another 3-hour, like a biographical. And I don't want to suggest that these films don't have narrative, because they do. But they go about it in his own very personal way.
This is the definition of personal cinema. Yeah.
And there are elements of, you know, experimental filmmaking in this, like, you know, sped up, slowed down, you know, images on top of each other, you know, all of that stuff. And but they're so wonderful to watch. 3 hours just flies by. And then there's one that is on Fandor that I watched just this week that does not fly by. It's an hour long. He recorded...
I know which one you're talking
about. Presentation. He recorded a play called The Brig at the Living Theater.
That was one of his early films.
Yeah. 1964. I thought I would die by the time
it was not over. You know, that kind of narrative was not... I mean, that, you know, when we say that there's narrative in these other movies, it's the narrative of his life, you know, and so it's episodic the way our lives are episodic, you know, and rather than having a kind of quote unquote strong narrative, it's his life. Whereas The Brig was based on, and I agree, The Brig did not do it for me either. but, you know, he had been very against avant-garde cinema, and then he embraced it, and he embraced it with a passion, and then he stopped writing for The Voice, and he really became a great champion of true off Hollywood. And we should mention there are three other, it's been a really bad year for experimental and avant-garde filmmakers. Barbara Hammer, Carolee Schneeman, and Phil Solomon are three other filmmakers who died this year. And their work can be difficult to see, but you can find it, and all are worth searching out.
You can find Carolee Schneeman's short film Fuses on Vimeo. And there's no password. It's like, it's just there.
Yeah.
And it is a 18-minute short where she and her partner at the time, the composer James Tenney, are having sex.
With a lot of visual manipulation.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. And the image it's obscure, but also beautiful. She was kind of a brackage kind of working.
Very much.
Maya Deren.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting film in that it presents sex in a very frank way that doesn't fetishize
the female body,
her body.
Yeah.
And that's important. She became a professor at CalArts. And there's a lot of her stuff that I have not seen because it's much more difficult to come by.
Right. I mean, a lot of times a lot of the work I would see actually in theaters, you know, or at shows.
Right.
And if, you know, depending on where you are and what part of the country, you might be lucky enough there's a museum or there's an alternative space. You know, here we have Film Forum and some other places in New York City. There are, of course, more places to see work. But you can find things. And some of these people were putting their work out in the world because they wanted their work out and were distributing it. So, you know, this is work that's really worth seeing, and I think worth championing in a way that I feel it's become more and more important to champion the off-Hollywood work, because the kind of dominant cinema is so dominant these days. You just mentioned the Avengers, you know.
Right.
I just feel like there's so little oxygen in the room for anybody but Disney and Marvel sometimes, you know.
And Nitrate Kisses, I think,
This is Barbara Hammer's Nitro Kisses.
I thought we were lumping all these together.
I just wanted to say that that's Barbara Hammer's,
Yes, Barbara Hammer's Nitro Kisses, I think, kind of fits into the new queer cinema narrative in a way, just certainly for time, if nothing else. It came out in 1993.
But no one says it, which has driven me mad this entire time. Because
I'm sure Ruby includes it because she talks talks about Sadie Benning and people that aren't necessarily making
Ruby Rich, great theorist and one of the critic and
coiner of the name the New Queer Cinema and author of the book by the same
right exactly.
Barbara She's Hammer, been on the show.
You want to see Barbara Hammer's stuff? She was like, in terms of like keeping herself, commodified on the internet. She had it. Like, you go to BarbaraHammer.com, you can buy those DVDs.
Yeah.
She's selling them. Yep. She's like Frederick Wiseman. Hey, I've got my own website. I'm selling my own DVDs. And she was not waiting at all for someone else to come along and say, yeah, we really need to give you a retrospective.
We'll do the business part for you, and as somebody who is a big Right to Die activist myself, I am hugely in admiration of how she handled her own final period.
She
there.
Did an exit interview with the New Yorker, which I thought was really great.
Mm-hmm.
She came out as a lesbian. She came out as a lesbian in the early 1970s. She was married to a man, and then she's like, you know what? I think I'm a feminist. You know what else? I think I'm a lesbian. And from that moment on, she made lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of lesbian sex films, which were, for me, as a young gay guy in the early 90s, trying to figure out, like, what is this community? Are we a community? And realizing really quickly that the community was very fractured and splintered off into, we may all have gone to the same gay bar in Fort Worth, Texas, because there just weren't that many.
Right.
But when the gay film festival happened in Dallas, and you went to a lesbian documentary and you were a guy, you were the guy in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always sit there and think to myself, hey, gays, why are you not here with the lesbians? Don't you want to know? Like, they're telling you all their secrets right here. Don't you want to know?
Every year at Outfest, the whoever the director of programming is in the opening speech says, please go see a movie about people who are not like you.
Right.
And that's always the challenge. And even, like, I think lesbians are more likely to go support a gay movie than vice versa. The gays are the worst when it comes to supporting anybody else, much less the lesbians.
So Nitrate Kisses, right, comes out in 1992. It's part of the Whitney Biennial. But who gets to see it? Well, crazily enough, there was a repertory house in Dallas at the time run by a gay male couple. It lasted 2 whole years.
Ooh.
And they couldn't get audiences to come down to that part of town on, a Tuesday night to see the one night showing of Nitrate Kisses.
It was the Texas Theater where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested.
Oh.
No.
Wasn't it?
Nope. There was the other one. It was not called the Texas. It was over on the...
But it was down in Oak Cliff though, right?
No. It was over...
Never mind. I don't know anything.
It was... It was over in the southeastern part of Dallas.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Scratch that.
So anyway, it was the Grand.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was my wheels were spinning. What was the name of it? It was the Grand. So anyway, I go see Nitrate Kisses on a Tuesday night. There's two other people in the theater.
Oh.
They are ladies. And this movie is a documentary that just is about queer bodies doing sex. So you had a lesbian couple that were BDSM, you had a mixed race gay male couple, and then, like, for the grand finale, two, like, 80-year-old lesbians getting it on. And I was riveted. So I was like, I've never been allowed to see this ever.
Uh-huh.
Like, this is not, you're sure as hell not seeing this in porn. And, or at least not the porn that I can find. And I mean, now just go to Pornhub and you can find
everything.
You can see it all on Pornhub. But like back then, if you were young and queer and you wanted some kind of example of what was out there, oh my, what
the future might
that
hold
was the
for
movie
you.
That would burn a hole in your face, because she was the one who was giving you, she was giving you body, her own body, quite a bit.
Yeah.
In the exit interview with her partner, blanking on her first name, last name Burke, they talk about meeting at, they've been together, they were together like 40 years. They met at the Women's Music Festival in California. And she said, and we were both naked. I was like, this totally scans. Like, she made she started doing this in the 70s, like a short film called
Dyke
Tactics. It was a very like hippie lesbian short, but just everybody naked and grooving on each other and stuff. And if you are not in a group of people and you want to know what that group of people is doing, go see their movies.
So, I mean, just to say one thing, like, there's this just reminds me of a film that Agnes Varda made with a bunch of naked people, including some naked pregnant women. And the radicalness of women showing naked, the naked female body, you know, naked female bodies, let's put it that way, the plurality of it, the difference of it.
Under the female gaze.
Under women making movies showing, this is how I'm going to show bodies, which is very different. And if we think, it may not seem very radical, but I would say it is very radical.
It is.
You know, this is very much part of the project of second wave feminism and women liberating themselves from men, you know, not just being, not necessarily being, never having any sort of relationship with men, but just saying, our bodies exist on our own terms, you know, bodies ourselves, you know, and I think it's really important to kind of remember that and, you know, to think how radical it was for women to do this, to show a naked pregnant woman, to show two older women getting it on. This is really radical.
It's like when Tig Notaro takes her shirt off in her Netflix special to show her double mastectomy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's
absolutely.
Like, nobody, we don't see that. And, you know, and it's for women to sort of reclaim that visual and be like, you know, we aren't just here to be experienced or judged by men. We just exist and here we are.
Go on.
Oh, there's this great way that Agnes Varda talked about Cleo 5-7, and she says that Cleo goes from being a woman who is looked at to a woman who looks.
Yep.
And I think, you know, when we think about these kind of women filmmakers in a way, is they're part of that project, you know, that if they are kind of, if women have historically, you know, been looked at, just walk around any European museum and just see all the women, naked or not, that have been looked at, and then watch all your movies. You have female filmmakers who are doing something really radical by they themselves are looking at female bodies and presenting them differently, perhaps, and saying, look, there's another way to do this. Just that's all I just needed to interject that.
The beginning of Nitrate Kisses, there's a quote from Adrienne Rich on the screen, and I found it. I'm going to read it. Whatever is unnamed, undepicted in images, whatever is omitted from biography, censored in collections of letters, whatever is misnamed as something else, made difficult to come by, whatever is buried in the memory by the collapse of meaning under an inadequate or lying language, this will become not merely unspoken, but unspeakable.
Oh, so good.
Which brings us to Wild Nights with Emily.
Right. That's what we were just talking about when we were talking about Wild Nights with Emily. Yeah.
That's a great quote.
Who do we have left in this?
That's basically it. I did want to loop back. You mentioned briefly the shadow on the end of Makis's life.
Oh, yes.
I don't know what this is.
This is, there was an article appeared in the New York Review of Books last year, late last year. I believe it was last year. It might have been the year before. Sorry. Talking about Makis, where he was during the war. He was a teenager during the war, and he was working for a newspaper. And basically the claim is that were these Nazi-supporting newspapers. And Makis, this guy, was doing research in Lithuania and wrote a really long article that Makis took issue with. And Amy Taubin's written about this. And it created a division. And Makis said, you know, these were not Nazi paper. Like, they initially, before the they saw the Germans initially, he said, as liberators from the Soviets. And then the Germans come in and they're Nazis. And so they're not actually liberators.
Right.
And that these newspapers, he said, had a that they had these kind of German covers, but that everything else was, you know, Lithuanian. And he disputed it and he talks about it. And I feel like people need to make up their own mind. There has been some, as I said, written about it. You can read the line. I think it's not under the paywall. New York Review of Books, Jonas Mekas, and then Amy Taubin writing about it. And she interviewed Mekas. And it really caused a lot of painful kind of moments for people. But Mekas really addressed it in ways that I felt were really satisfactory. And certainly no one was accusing him of being a Nazi, mm-hmm. and no one was accusing him of having perpetrated any crimes. But it was more, was he as upfront about what he was doing during the war? And again, this is before the Final Solution, right. again, as he could have been. And perhaps he wasn't, you know. Mm-hmm. But as his friend Ken Jacobs has said, life is complicated. So it's, you know, I'm just saying that the people in his life and his legacy, this is a shadow, but I don't think it's a career damaging one at all.
Fair enough. Interesting. I did not know about that.
Let's go read up on that.
I got to look into it. Yeah, for sure. Manola, you're a delight. Thank you for being here.
Gentlemen, this is so much fun. Thank you. I'm always so honored to be asked over.
You are an active tweeter and Instagrammer. Where can people find you?
At Manola Dargis on Twitter, where I'm usually being very cranky. And I'm on Instagram. It's usually my cat, Bob. But, you know.
And who doesn't want to see that?
It's always your cat.
It's not always. Every so often I write something like the Varda appreciation, and I'll put that online. But it's like I tend not to push too much of my own stuff because it just seems kind of silly.
And a quick reminder to folks, the New Beverly in Los Angeles, if you're here, is doing a ton of women-directed films this month, including this Friday and Saturday, double feature of, and it took me a while to put this together, Strange Days and Lizzie Borden's...
Born in Flames.
Born in Flames,
oh.
yes. Which are not only both these sort of like post-apocalyptic, right. but Kathryn Bigelow is in Born in Flames, and she directed Strange Days. So
yep.
golf clap for whoever put those two together. Well played.
Would you like to know about the Patreon system?
Oh, we should totally mention that.
I will tell you all about it right now very quickly. We do three other podcasts besides this one. You want to hear them? You're going to pay us. We're selling a thing. You want to listen? You buy it. You go to patreon.com/linoleumknife. You can listen to LKTV, which is a podcast of the television. You can listen to Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a food podcast hosted by two film critics. You can listen to Linoleum Nights, where we work blue. And all the F words
yes.
are in that one. And, you know, then there's also like the t-shirts and the mugs and the badges and the
private knife.
Yeah. Private knife, which is you tell us the subject matter and we record you your own private 15 to 20 minute, 30 if we go real crazy with the subject podcast. It's only for you, just for you.
Individualized.
Yeah. So we're very busy. and that means if you want to subscribe, go do it. There's a video and there's all an explanation. Everything you need to know is there. So that's it.
And this is a special, so I'll spare you the usual plugs at the end. But I will say, if you have not listened to our episode with Elliot Kalin from the Flophouse, where we talk about Avengers Endgame.
Oh, yeah.
It came out real well.
I thought so.
I think you should check it out, yeah. whatever your thoughts about the movie were. You could also subscribe.
I didn't like it when Molly Ringwald died.
Yeah, I know. That's always a heartbreaker.
She's my favorite Avenger.
Subscribe and leave a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts. Yay, we have some 5-star reviews. We're going to read those on the regular episode this week. Thank you for...
It's amazing what commanding people to do yes. something will do.
Sometimes they will hop too, and I greatly appreciate it. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Spotify and TheLounge.com and Google Play and whatnot. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Thank you, Manola. We'll be back tomorrow Woo. With reviews of Longshot and Burial of Kojo and lots of other stuff. So until then...
Goodbye.
Goodbye.